papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. Or I meet politics.
The Media Project gives you a half hour of commentary and analysis on what's going on in the news media with some newsroom veterans, and we're happy to welcome you to join in the conversation. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, now of the Upstate American, here with Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette, vice president of the New York Press Association. How you doing, Judy?
Happy day.
Happy day it is. And has been, will be. David Gustina is here, WAMC's morning host and producer of this program.
I send the topics for the show, of which I've read none, so I apologize.
All right, David. Here is Ian Pickus, the news director of Northeast Public Radio. Sir, how are you?
Just want to say for everybody who's decided to tune back into the news after Labor Day, welcome back. We've been here the whole time.
Absolutely. Nobody has taken a vacation. Well, people have taken vacations, but it's been going on, which is a wonderful thing. In fact, people are probably finding, as is the case these days, that the news follows them. It used to be that you would lose track of the news and maybe, you know, you walk away from your devices somewhat now. It's harder not to keep in touch with the news, because it's not just like walking away from your subscription to the daily newspaper. Here's one thing that I found interesting in the news recently, and that is the spread of TikTok as a news source. A couple of years ago, when we talked about that on this program, it was just kind of a joke. But nowadays, we're finding that half of TikTok users under the age of 30 say they use it to keep up with politics and news. And the number is high even among older people, even those over 65. About a quarter of the TikTok users use it to keep up with the news.
Including Ira.
Including Ira Fussfeld, our sometimes colleague here on the Media Project. Which is remarkable. And I wonder, Ian, does Northeast Public Radio have a presence on TikTok? Are you trying to do this?
Not yet, but I think it's on the list. And I guess this is good news because the TikTok algorithm shows you more of what you're looking at and what you want. So this could suggest that people are seeking news out on TikTok. And because of that, they are seeing more news in their feed than they normally would. The warning I would have is the same for all social media platforms, which is to beware of the computerized version of what you're seeing and make sure that it's reputable. Just because something is claiming to be news on TikTok does not mean it is necessarily. So I would stick with the same sort of trusted outlets that you have in other forms to begin with.
Yeah, I just want to echo that. I agree with Ian 100% on that. I noted in a previous program that when I asked my 12 students in the class where they get their news from, their primary news source was TikTok. You also witnessed all these social media influencers now being given press credentials to be at the conventions recently. And, you know, that is a sign of the influence of not only TikTok, but of social media in general as people's more now than likely first choices for news.
You know, when I first read these statistics, I thought, oh, they just think news is, when is Taylor Swift going to drop her next album or what movie is coming out? But it's clear that this is hard news that people are consuming on TikTok. And then the challenge for every news media company is to find a way to present important information on this platform. And it's not easy. It requires us to change our approach to news. And what I find on TikTok too often is a snippet of information. And maybe that's how people will consume information going forward, a snippet at a time.
That difficulty, of course, because so much of the news that is important is the context. So much that we value as journalists is giving background and substance and doing the sort of investigative or just accountability reporting that doesn't lend itself to quick headlines.
But I like what Ian said about how we probably need to move over there because we'll get in that algorithm and they'll get that repeated news that they're taking in. At the same time, when you have brands that equal trust in many people's minds, like WAMC, like the New York Times, and all these other places, if they start putting their presence and keep their presence there as well, I think that's a good thing because these are legitimate journalism of verification news organizations. And if they get their presence on TikTok, you know, they're going to have to be creative about how they do this to keep the context, to make sure it's targeted. But I think that's a good move.
Of course, that could kill TikTok. I mean, the reason that a lot of the other social media platforms have moved away from news, have tried to depress the news presence on their sites, is because it drives down audience participation, right? You might say that people, as they see more so-called trusted brands on TikTok, will find it less amusing and therefore won't participate as much.
It's like in the old days, you know, most people turn to the comics or the sports section first of the newspaper, and you try to sneak in some vegetables too. It just makes me laugh because one criticism of broadcast media has always been that it fosters a soundbite culture. But at WAMC, we're playing long soundbites compared to what you will ever find on TikTok. And that seems to be the way of the future here.
Yeah. I have a friend who is a correspondent for CBS News who some years ago was moaning about the fact that there had been actuality that was seven words. That is, they'd used actual tape of an event and it was a public official uttering only seven words. And she said, I can't believe that we used a seven word actuality. Well, that's not that unusual, actually. Actually, dropping in a bit of tape for tape.
We call it that still.
Yeah, you can say it. It's okay. We understand.
I know. What a funny thing, tape. But dropping in that little bit of it does add credibility. It adds life. It's terrific. That's what makes this medium so powerful. But it is the short stuff that draws people's attention, and the longer stuff sends people away sometimes.
We in the newspaper industry tend to get hung up on reading, rightfully so. but not everybody is a great reader, and not everybody absorbs information well via the written word. Some people learn better with their ears. So some people learn better, absorb more information by watching videos. And I think we need to shed this fanciful notion that everybody needs to read a 30-inch story in order to be well-informed.
I don't know. I kind of like being smug and
smug. And they're not even rejecting us.
I
when
know.
We talk about
I know it's tough.
Well, yeah. You know, I think you should read it all because there's always a nugget down further. And you know, when you're just looking at headlines, just read a Drudge headline and then go to the story. You know, asteroid could destroy Earth 2036. So then you look into the article. Well, it's not going to really come close to Earth, but it's the closest one that's ever come to Earth. You know, you don't read enough, you're going to be misled at some point.
I'm sorry, David, but even referencing Drudge is so 1992, you know.
You know what? I'm so back in that era. Still.
But, you know, the power of this is underscored by the fact that even on X, formerly Twitter, which has fallen so much under the leadership of Elon Musk that it is much less relevant than it used to be. But even so, there's a stunning statistic, David, in one of the pieces that you shared with us. It arises from the fact that Elon Musk, the owner of X, posted an AI-generated image on his account, which he pushes out to everybody on X, that shows Kamala Harris as a communist wearing a red uniform with a hammer and sickle emblazoned hat. You know, it's not real, of course. But within less than 24 hours after he did that, the post had been viewed nearly 60 million times. And he had done another post suggesting that women shouldn't take part in democracy. That was viewed more than 19 million times. I mean, the power of these platforms suggests that we have to be there if we're interested in getting the news out to people.
Musk has engineered his platform so that he gets top billing every time I log on. I would almost question whether or not 60 million people actually looked at that video. Maybe they passed it by. I remember early on in the Facebook video days, there was questions about whether or not you saw a post just because you happened to scroll through it. But again, Musk should be censured for, you know, promoting at an unfair advantage these dangerous memes, videos, posts. He is destroying that platform. It will go the way of Facebook does in terms of irrelevance and when it comes to news. Snapchat, remember that? Everything comes and then it goes.
Yeah, I'm nostalgic for the days when Twitter was a cesspool on the merits. Not because it's been rejiggered so that you're seeing a lot of really hateful and nasty posts in the top of the feed when you log on. I will say, as someone who has stayed on it, the replacements have not yet filled the void that Twitter would leave, or X would leave, in my opinion. I think Threads is incredibly difficult to navigate for news. It doesn't work as a great breaking news platform. And some of the others are too bespoke to reach the mass audience, especially when a lot of us have a decade plus of building up followers and people who are in our fields who used to make the place be worth checking on. I find it very depressing, just like you. I don't think it's going in the right direction as a user, just based on what I see in my feed. And also, if we have breaking news here and we put it out on Twitter, we get far less engagement than we ever did before Elon Musk bought it.
Hmm. So do you have to put it out on multiple platforms? What do you do with breaking news?
Yeah, and I tried to use Threads for that myself. I don't think it works all that well. It's just cut off an avenue unless you want to pay for your artificial verification checkmark to get your post boosted, which to me, that's not worth it.
Ian, do you see any evidence through our social media that we are getting younger, a younger audience? Because I think that's the trick. We're not listening traditionally, young people, to the radio the way that those in our older brackets do. So is it working? Are we getting any traction with the younger audience?
In my experience, anecdotally, I think younger people are more likely to see individual things as opposed to having the station on for 12 hours a day and tuning in when they're interested. I think that's a totally different type of audience now.
We've been talking about this for a while, actually, that the assumption now is, especially among our younger generation, not that I will go look for the news, but the news will find me if it's important. And that is sort of the way social media is constructed, so that you put yourself into a position to receive information and people will present it out there.
Supposedly. Isn't there something else in this X story, too? Elon Musk's a billionaire, and money has influence. And people who can buy influence, like a social media platform like X, then have power over individuals in terms of how they organize that information. And it's the same kind of thing we worry about in ownership of the press, and that a former member and creator of this program used to criticize you guys all the time. I can see the opinion leaking over into the columns. But we are in a place now where we have all these alternatives to deliver information, and those with the money really have a certain power.
Yes. And I think it's true that the origins of the contemporary media ecosystem in America were partisan. You know, I've said before, I was the editor of a little newspaper in Indiana called The Republican. Mm-hmm. And there was another newspaper literally across the alley called The Democrat. And these papers were positioned to support their parties. And the paper that I became the editor of here in Albany, the Times Union, was founded as the Albany Morning Times in 1856 to be a counterforce to that, to not be partisan. And that is what then emerged. Finally, there came about a nonpartisan press. And whatever people may say about it, the fact is most of the philosophy and the standards of American journalism were such that these wealthy people who owned printing presses, who put out newspapers, still had standards in their newsrooms that suggested that they were trying to be fair and did all they could to have valid journalism that gave people the information they needed. And that's what's been lost by Elon Musk in his effort to simply project his ego and those whose support he covets, Donald Trump foremost. That's what's been lost there. There is no ethical foundation for that kind of decision making.
So is this the new yellow journalism?
Yeah. Yes. What else could you say? It's tragic. Now, there is a lot of good news out there. I mean, I was just recently reading an interview with Neil Brown, who is just finishing his term as chair of the Pulitzer Prize Board. He's the head of the Poynter Foundation, which runs this journalism think tank down in Florida and owns the Tampa Bay Times, which is formerly St. Petersburg Times, a wonderful newspaper. And he's talking about how there are actually good things going on in the media, and public radio being among them. You know, even though there are financial headwinds in a lot of these things, there's a lot of great journalism going on, and there are new nonprofit newsrooms springing up all over, whether it be the Lookout in Santa Cruz, California, which won a Pulitzer Prize for its coverage of natural disasters, New York Focus here in New York State, or Mississippi Today, which won a Pulitzer Prize. We featured one of their reporters in this program a few months ago. There is a lot of good stuff going on in this new journalism ecosystem, but it's not happening on those big platforms. That's not where the great dynamic of journalism is happening. You have to hope that those big platforms will be responsible enough to pick up this great journalism and run with it, give it an avenue, because that's the only way that it's going to actually get to most people.
And by big platforms, you mean the social media companies?
Yeah.
I mean, Musk bought Twitter, also known as X, and professed his support of the First Amendment and being nonpartisan. But now he's endorsed Trump, and his platform endorses Trump and allows the dissemination of false information, disinformation, Facebook is kind of abandoning news and filling our feeds with cats and dogs and good news.
And the bots are working overtime to target those with Facebook profiles and others to spout the opinions that they want to get to those people. But I think A.G. Sulzberger is the canary in the coal mine.
You're right there. Now, that's interesting. What Dave is referring to is an opinion piece written by the publisher of the New York Times that appeared in the Washington Post. A.G. Sulzberger wrote this warning about, as the headline put it, the quiet war against press freedom, likening what went on in Viktor Orban's Hungary and India under Modi as to what could happen in America and what Donald Trump is actually threatening to have happen in his assertion that broadcast licenses should be taken away from his opponents and that he's going to get even with those who stand against him. And yet, if you are the media, I mean, what A.G. Sulzberger is warning about, you would think if there is such a great threat to press freedom, why is he having to say this on an opinion page? Why isn't he putting this on the front page of the New York Times? Do our journalistic standards of trying to be fair to everyone get in the way of the truth of the threat that this presents?
You know, the New York Times has come under a great attack in the last couple of months for what people will say is their false equivalents, that they are not giving the Donald Trump campaign enough of a hard look and have not elaborated on his missteps and his mental state and the egregious things he says. In the op-ed that Sulzberger wrote, he said he had no interest in wading into politics, and he disagrees with those who have suggested that the risk Trump poses to the free press is so high that news organizations such as mine should cast aside neutrality and directly oppose his reelection. Now, I would argue that it's not neutrality that's the issue here. It's how they're framing the story so often that it overlooks many of the egregious things that Trump has said and is proposing to do.
Yeah, and part of that is, so you take the example of Arlington National Cemetery, where they go along quoting the Trump source for how the event went and sort of frame it as if it's a he said, she said story, and we don't get to what really was wrong about that issue. And I think just what you say, when you frame a story, how are you reaching that audience in such a way that it's not about neutrality, it's about truth telling?
You know, I should mention that the Trump campaign promised to release a video that would show the truth of what happened at Arlington National Cemetery, and it's many days later, and we still have not seen the video. Maybe by the time this airs, fingers crossed that that will happen, but I doubt it, seriously.
I don't think the video will show what they want it to show, and that could be the problem, unless it's heavily edited, and you're not going to get a congressional committee demanding the full release of that the way that, you know, supposedly they did on the January 6th video.
How much of this do you think is the fact that it's highly unusual, putting aside the personality and the type of candidate he is, but we've very rarely had in American history somebody run for three straight elections? There's relatively little left to learn about Donald Trump as compared to Kamala Harris, who has only really been a national figure for the last few years and only very late is the Democratic nominee in this race. So she gets a type of attention from, you know, people like Dana Bash in that interview and trying to look at positions like fracking that, frankly, at this point, Donald Trump just doesn't get that type of coverage because when he, you know, goes at a campaign speech and says some wild things, it's really not anything new.
Or it's understood to be just Trump blathering. You know, the problem is he does say outrageous things in speeches, but it is assumed to be just the sort of talk that he does. And you're right. It's nothing new. We've heard this from him before, and the Republic didn't collapse. And so maybe
it
got attacked. It got attacked. I mean,
yeah.
Come on. And we do know Trump. We do. We also know that he's been so slick in the way he comports himself that he's been able to get away with more than any single human being in history for the acts that he's committed. And he still creates doubt among people.
I think what A.G. Sulzberger points out in the Post is that citizens don't really pay attention to the threat that is presented when the First Amendment is under attack, when press freedom is really being restricted. I had forgotten that toward the end of his administration, the Justice Department seized the phone logs of reporters at the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN. That's fairly outrageous, which is very much like what happened with Modi in India, where literally the newsroom of the BBC in Delhi was shut down, was seized by the government, and everyone was evicted for 3 days while government officials went through the files there. And the notion that funding will be eliminated for Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which would have quite an impact on PBS and NPR, of course, which Trump contends have presented coverage that is difficult for him to swallow. So I think it is really a difficult thing to figure out if it is such a huge threat that it does really present a threat to press freedom in America, then A.G. Sulzberger ought to be using everything at his disposal to contest it somehow.
You know, I think we should do a far better job as an industry of extolling the virtues of a free press, why it matters. Because if you ask the average American, they may not have a problem with the government looking at what calls the reporters are making, or they may not understand why it's okay for a newspaper to publish confidential information or classified information. We even saw a little bit of this over the debate over whether or not Harris should have given that interview to Dana Bash at CNN, where people are saying press needs to get off her back. The press is just a tool. She shouldn't have to talk to the press. She shouldn't have to answer questions. I mean, we were getting this from the left at that point, and they were not understanding or appreciating the value that a serious interview with a potential president of the United States could bring to the fore.
Actually, I've been wanting to ask Ian this because you do a lot of interviews with politicians. How did you think Dana Bash did with her interview of Harris?
I think it's a no-win situation for somebody in that spot. There's too much to cover. There's not enough time. She got some criticism that I saw for asking a day one question, which is a bit of a cliche. I thought it was very substantive. You learned some new things about that team. She pinned her down on some places where she appears to have changed her positions over the years. So it's an impossible task. I thought it was as good as it could have been, frankly.
The hard thing is when you're interviewing a politician and they evade your question, and I've heard you do this, you go back and say, let me just repeat the question that I asked or something like that. You try to get them to answer the question, but eventually, you know, they will keep talking and you can't necessarily get that. So you kind of have to move on and get something else. And
plus, you had Tim Walz sitting there, which is different. It's sort of a strange
one
thing.
One-on-two is not one-on-one.
That is not a real good way to do interviews.
Well, I suspect that was actually a condition of the campaign, right? We'll give you the two only, or something like that.
You know, these broadcast interviews, again, I will set aside my bias towards sit-down newspaper interviews, but they're just performances. If you listen to cable news every day, someone will ask a question, and the person will come and answer the question that they wanted to be asked. They don't answer the real questions.
But won't they do that to you, too, in an editorial board meeting?
Maybe in an editorial board meeting, but if you sit down with someone for 2 or 3 hours and you're a print journalist or even a broadcast journalist that gets the real time to ask different kinds of questions, to find out where the person comes from, tell me something new, tell me something interesting, and that's what so often these interviews miss.
But then they don't read to the end of the article.
While we're talking about this, I will just say, doing the Congressional Corner, it is something that keeps me up at night, because after it's over, you hear it again. Did I do this right? Should I have done this differently? It's impossible to probably get it 100% right. I will say, and I don't know if I've ever said this on the air before, but people who listen to those segments should know, sometimes you know the answer to the question that you're asking, and sometimes the answer, even if it's not answering the question you asked, tells you something about the candidate. Mm-hmm. And I think to look at it as just a Q&A running through a list of questions, it's not the entire story always.
It's got to be
mean?
The conversation.
It's a conversation. You know the answer to the question. That is, you know what their stance on the issue is, but you like to know how they're going to present it? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and I think we can learn something from the type of candidate they are, what their priorities are. Are they serious? Do they know their facts? Do they seem well-versed on this issue that's listed as a priority on their website? Mm-hmm. The way they answer that can often tell you something, even if it's not just a piece of information included in that answer.
Yeah, this is one of the things I love about radio that is actually, I've been saying this for years, and it's not just to appease you guys who run these microphones, but it is that hearing a person's voice, hearing how they answer a question gives you, there's verisimilitude there. There's an accuracy that you can't get that doesn't come through oftentimes in print without an awful lot of reporter input and describing the scene. And it doesn't even come through in television sometimes because people are distracted often by the visual. When you just hear a voice and when that is what you have going on, that's very powerful. And the other good thing is that you can get somebody on a phone. They are more accessible. You're more likely to get somebody for an audio interview than necessarily a visual interview.
Well, this week I talked to the head of the Conservative Party of New York State, Gerard Jerry Kassar. And
okay.
I tried to reach out to him the normal way. We would through the flack, and nobody's responding. So I picked up the phone, called the office, and he answered the phone.
Excellent.
He said, I'll do it with you right now. So yeah. We had a conversation. Now he gets into topics, and I know Ian was expressing this, that you know the listener's going to be writing, so why didn't you be tougher? Why didn't you follow up? And for example, one of the questions had to do with China and the agent allegedly in the two governors' administrations in New York working for the Chinese government. And I had to follow up with, well, your party endorsed Donald Trump. He supports dictators. He, you know, and that kind of thing. And he answered the question. But the point being that I'm sure I didn't ask it tough enough. There'll be people that will be mad at me because I didn't follow up three more times. But you can only ask the question and get the answer. You can't beat people to death over the head with it.
And that's all we have time for today. Unfortunately, we can't beat people over the head with more of our program today. I just do want to thank Robert of Schenectady, who sent us this letter. Dear Media Project, Vietnam War, 63 journalists killed in 20 years. World War II, 67 journalists in 7 years. Gaza, 176 journalists in 10 months. This is a violation of the Geneva Protocols. So thank you, Robert, for sending us that. We appreciate hearing from listeners. Media at WAMC.org is how you can share your thoughts. That's it for the Media Project. Here with Ian Pickus and David Gustina and Judy Patrick, I'm Rex Smith. We thank you for joining us and hope we will see you again next week here on the Media Project.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and WAMC news director Ian Pickus. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.